Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 227, featuring Darren Grant on this second time that he's been on and his new role as CTO of Animal Logic. And I'm going to get into what Darren talks about because it is a monster podcast. But before we do that, let's see a couple of announcements. I am back from Sofia. I'm in LA now. And this is where we had an amazing Total Chaos. And I want to thank all of our speakers who were there, who were absolutely incredible, as well as all the attendees who were super enthusiastic and gave us some great feedback. And it was a great, great event. So we are really looking forward to seeing how we can outdo ourselves again in the next time in 2020. So really great to do that. There are going to be some announcements coming out soon. Obviously, there was a lot of stuff that was said at Total Chaos. So new products, new updates, all coming out soon. So keep an eye out on those. Go to chaosgroup.com for all your news feed and news information, as well as any events that are going on. Check out our events section on the website, and you will be able to see all the great stuff going on there. So I'm very excited about that. I'm actually pre-recording this well ahead of time because I'm going to be going on vacation and it's long overdue. I have not been on vacation for a while, so it'll be good to do that. Hopefully this podcast comes out on time. It's going to be hard to predict that because of me trying to post it while I'm on vacation. Nonetheless, all right, let's get into this podcast with Darren Grant because, like I said, it is a monster. We cover so many different important subjects in terms of technology and the industry that it is huge. So we jump all over the place in terms of subject back and forth. So I'm not going to give this in the order that we talk about it, but I'm going to get into several things. One of them is obviously Darren is a part of the, besides being the CTO of Animal Logic, he is also part of the SciTech Awards at the Academy. So for those of you who don't know, the scientific and technology awards that are given out by the Academy come out every year. They're part of the Academy Awards. And back in 2016, which was the first time that Darren was on, by the way, and if you guys really should listen to the September 2016 podcast I did with him, which is episode number 88, to hear more of Darren's backstory, because we don't talk about it so much in this one, but you guys should check that out. Anyway, back in 2016, Darren was one of the people who basically recommended, hey, you guys should submit for the SciTech Awards. And we ended up doing that and we ended up winning. So it was a really great thing. And I really want to thank Darren for, you know, recommending that we do that at that time. Besides the SciTech Awards, he is also part of the ASWF, which is the Academy Software Foundation, which is another part of the Academy. But that's brand new, and it involves big companies, technology companies, as well as visual effects companies that are all getting together to try to support open source software in different kinds. So we talk a little bit about what the ASWF is, which I think is pretty interesting for those of you who want to know more about that. He also mentions the fact that he is on the SIGGRAPH animation jury this year and part of the festival there, and talks about you know, how student projects have changed so much in the many, many years that he's been involved in that area, which is really fascinating. We also talk about, you know, back in 2016, we were talking about how cloud was something that people were very reluctant to get into because of security and all these other concerns. Well, fast forward to today in 2019, cloud is much more accepted in terms of visual effects and how it's being used in terms of rendering and backup. We talk about that in general and how people use it, as well as where he sees cloud going in the future, which is also a fascinating conversation. So we talk a lot about cloud, as well as rendering and ray tracing and real time. All of those things are an important part of understanding where all that technology is going. Then we also, along the podcast, there's several big subjects that we talk about that are much more controversial for our users, people that are interested to know more about that. Darren was played an important part at Solid Angle. Solid Angle are the people that make Arnold, and he was helping Solid Angle during the acquisition by Autodesk, and talks a lot about software companies being acquired, what that means, and what that means in general, how it benefits certain companies and also to users. You know, we even talk about more recently how Maxon acquired Redshift and what that means for that product, why you would do something like that, his thoughts on, you know, what that means, as well as even the Foundry. The Foundry got bought again recently and what that means for business. So really fascinating conversation in that area. And we also talk about another controversial subject, which is software subscription and how what that means and what people can do with that and why software subscription may be a better way to go, both for the company as well as for the users in certain cases. So it was a really interesting conversation. Darren is a fascinating person. He really has a great insight in terms of the business and technology of you know, in terms of visual effects and computer graphics. So really great person. In fact, I think that we should probably consider having Darren on more often on the podcast, maybe on a yearly basis to say, hey, you know, catching up on the business side of technology and that sort of thing. So really cool to have Darren on. Very, very insightful person. This podcast really could have been a 4 or 5 hour podcast multi-part, but it's amazing the amount of things that we discuss in an hour and a half. So really great to have Darren on. Thanks so much. With that, without further ado, let's get right into it.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
All right, Darren. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right. So there's a lot of stuff. I mean, you mentioned it. You know, it's like, hey, you know, when town, let's get together. Maybe we can record a podcast. There's so much state of the industry stuff that we can talk about.
Yeah.
Which is great. And since you've been on this podcast before, I figured people want to hear some of your history. They can go back to that old podcast.
Exactly.
So this is the sequel. So we've already established a character. I think what would be really cool is to catch up people first, you know, what you've been up to since then and what you're doing now. And so that we can know, you know, kind of what's going on.
God. So, when was I on?
God, it was, well, Parker was still here because Parker was on. It was maybe about 2 or 3 years ago.
2 or 3 years ago. So I was in New York at the time and I just happened to be out here for a job interview. And
I know when it was. I'll tell you very specifically, you came out here around the time of the SciTech Awards, and you were the one who basically convinced me that Vlado should submit V-Ray for the SciTech Awards at that time, at which point I told it to Vlado, and then ta-da, we won. So
yeah, well, congratulations.
Thank
congratulations.
You.
Congratulations. Yeah. I've been involved in the SciTech committee for about 14 years now.
Yeah.
And really focused on the software side of things rather than the car flippers or cool stuff like that. But
There was a mechanical horse that
was a mechanical horse that was pretty awesome. That was used in Seabiscuit and, and a bunch of other movies. Last Samurai, I think. So I get to see all that stuff, but really I focus on the software thing.
Right.
And it was that time. It was time. You know, has anybody ever talked about the SciTech process on here before?
We have okay. Because Doug Robel has been on too.
Yep.
So we talked about there. I think it's actually one of the most well thought out processes. Obviously, there are politics involved, but the committee seems extremely committed to actually giving everyone a fair chance at stuff. You know?
Yeah, I think one of the things that has changed a lot since I started. When I started, it was like this star chamber at the Academy that we all had to come into the meeting every 2 weeks, like so people would fly in.
Really? Right?
And so when you have only the committee members that can fly in, it's really Northern and Southern California, and that's basically it.
Right.
Right. And our industry has changed a lot since then. Like that's not the hub of visual effects anymore.
Right.
And so really trying to find ways. So we started using video conferencing, all this remote collaboration technology so that we can have people participate from all over the world.
Sure.
Right. So now we have people on the committee that are participating from WEDA, from London, from all sorts of places in London. I participate from Australia,
right.
All these different people, and I participated while I was in New York, all to make sure that it's more reflective of what the visual effects industry and feature film industry is today,
right.
versus just all focused on Hollywood.
Right.
Right. And so I think that's helped a bit.
Right.
Definitely still some people's predispositions that, it's all the old guard giving the old guard awards. But, all I can say is if you're in those rooms, you know that that's definitely not the case.
Right. Yeah. I remember specifically what was the QMC award and how that ended up going to what's his name? Who's there were so many renderers that were like saying, we all have some kind of technology that's similar to that. And ended up going to the guy who actually came up with the paper.
Yeah.
He's not even in the industry.
Yeah. And those are kind of rare. Those really only happen when we're awarding things that are in the industry.
Right.
Like if there was a seminal paper or something that really influenced that, mm-hmm. and nobody in this industry would have done it without that, then that kind of comes along as a pioneering award.
Right.
Along the way.
Yeah. It was pretty interesting. I like I said, I've always been respectful of the SciTech committee and what they do. And it's a lot to do with people, because there's people like you and there's people like Doug who I know, and I'm like, yeah, good people. So, that's a good thing. But you've been, I want to get down the line of all the other sort of organizations that you're involved with and stuff, but let's go back to what you were doing. So like that was around the time when we were, like we said, we were submitting for the SciTech Award, but you were still in New York. So what's going on since then?
So, New York is not a hotbed of places that need a global CTO
right.
in the visual effects industry. There's a lot of, there's actually a lot of visual effects work, and then obviously animation in upstate or in Connecticut, like right over the border with Blue Sky.
Right.
And games work as well. But it's a lot smaller. It's really been bolstered a lot by television, mm-hmm. Television exploding over the last few years and certainly commercial work. It's what I loved about being in New York in that industry, because I was involved with the VES there, I was on the board for a little bit, was that it felt like Soho. It felt like LA used to feel early on, where everybody knew each other at every company. And it wasn't like, I'm trying to protect my people. It was like, look, we have a downturn. You have some work. Like, here, you take these. Like, it's okay. More important that everybody has jobs
wow.
more than they're working for me.
Right.
And so there's a lot of sense of community there. Small, which I think just happens when it's a bit smaller, right?
Sure.
So that was really nice to see and feel, but they didn't need somebody like me in that industry there. Mm-hmm. So we deal with some of these other things. And so I ended up consulting a lot. Like,
okay.
I consulted for Solid Angle and Autodesk and that
right.
whole acquisition.
So you were basically one of the people that, obviously, Marcos and you were saying, okay, I'll help consult because there was an acquisition happening.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? Can you talk? I mean, obviously you cannot talk about too many details, but that transition of trying to figure out how to help that company deal with that acquisition.
Yeah. So to be clear, like I was mostly hired for the acquisition and transferring and making sure that transition happened. Like Marcos, heart and soul of that product forever.
Right.
Amazing, amazing engineering team there. And I came in as a quote unquote manager to do with all that kind of stuff that, Marcos had admitted himself that he hates to do.
Right.
I came in with Marcos and then, another close friend of ours, Sebastian Silwan.
I know Sebastian.
I came in, the day after the letter of intent was signed.
Right? Interesting.
So it was like to really, okay, there's a bunch of work that has to be done in order to make this successful.
Right.
You do it, Darren.
Got it.
So, let's see. A lot of stuff that happens first is just, is cleaning house.
Okay.
Right. Like, small independent startup trying to just grow and grow and grow. Things like some guy that's a close friend of yours gives you some code.
Right.
You incorporate it in the product. You never got the rights to use the code, but it's, you know, it's Joe. I know Joe. He would never, like, there's no big deal.
Yeah,
but acquired by a bigger company. They're like, wait, do you own this code or not? Oh, okay. Hey, Joe, can you sign this thing?
Right.
So a hint, if you're close to a company and all of a sudden they start to send you out a contributor licensing agreements, like, hey, could you just sign this for me? Could you just make sure that, like, I know that you meant that this code is mine, but can you make sure that it is mine?
Right. That just means that they're trying to get you out of some money.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it means that they're trying to get some money from themselves. Right. So when that kind of stuff starts to happen, you could go, maybe, you know, you might be acquired if it's like that. You might be a redneck if. Like,
yeah. Right.
So that happens. A lot of, you know, when you're acquired by a big company, they have to matrix you into this other organization, figuring out levels of people and compensation packages and what makes sense on that side. Did a lot of that work. I did a lot of cleanup of licensing agreements and things like that.
That sounds so amazingly interesting.
But
it all has to get done.
Yeah, it all has to get done. Right. And you know, I mean, I think one of the things, like, I love technology and I love working in this industry so much. And, we talked, I think last time I talked about my origin story, superhero, but one of my superhero powers is I really don't mind working with legal. I really don't mind working through that stuff because one of the reasons I became a manager was to help enable other people to do great things.
Right.
And if I can get some of that legalese stuff out of the way, so you just focus on improving the renderer and I can make sure that I clear all this stuff out of your way. So this continues to go on.
Right.
Right. I had to buy people computers and,
right.
Like, you know, it was like, oh, you know, it was kind of garage style. Like, oh yeah, I'm just using my own computer. Yeah. We can't really do that when we're part of Autodesk. Cause like that whole, you're developing our code on our machine. That kind of thing. So dealing with a lot of the day-to-day stuff that Marcus didn't want to deal with, talking about roadmaps and trying to produce roadmaps, trying to then, how do we take all these products and migrate them into Autodesk build system?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. The more I talk about this, sounds really, really boring.
But. No, but it makes sense. I think this is what people need to understand is like, that's a big deal. Like there's a lot of cleanup that has to happen. Like you said, you know, your developers can't be developing on their own computers, or if they're using their work computer, they can't be doing a bunch of personal stuff on it either.
You know? And then, you know, obvious to people who have gone through this several times, like,
You
know, went through kind of a negative feeling acquisition with Digital Domain when we're going through bankruptcy, and then this one, and then some other ones that I've been involved in. I guess the first thing, though, if you're a developer, it's core to developing that product, you're not going anywhere. You're still safe.
Right.
But there's a lot of general overhead, like,
right.
You know, sales and marketing and
the
website and all these kind of things where these are essentially things that could be shared services.
Right.
So when you have a big behemoth acquiring you, very often what will happen is you look at that and they'll say, well, we don't necessarily know how to sell your product yet, but we will.
Okay. So
you guys have like a year long runway.
And then
goodbye.
Right. And that those, yeah, because they'll just be absorbed by the Autodesk machine that's going to do the same
thing. Yeah, right? We have 1,000 people that are selling.
Right.
Yes, we can use your knowledge and help understand how to sell your product, but ultimately you're either going to become a part of our organization long-term, and we'll find some things for you to do, or you won't because you're focused on that product and that's not.
Right.
It's not. We can assimilate that into our gigantic machine. So
that was interesting. And obviously, you know, the history of the acquisition of Solid Angle by Autodesk was a done deal. And it's been for a while and seems to be going just fine, which is great for.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of the really interesting things was just the amount of vitriol that you have from the user base, right? How could you? I mean, there are some people that sent Marcos because he gave out his phone number to everybody, sent him some really awful stuff.
Really? Right?
And it's like, you know, this is a human being. And you should have him on to talk about some of his own personal struggles. Like growing a company is incredibly hard.
Yeah.
Right. And like thinking about, I have to make sure that we had 25 people on the payroll. These people are earning enough money every month, every week to make sure that these people get their paychecks. So it's not just them, it's their families. It's stressful.
Yeah.
Right. And as he was growing that company, like year over year, really doubling revenue. Like there's a point when everybody says, I don't think I can work this hard anymore.
Right.
Right. And that's why you have, like, you have this classic, you've heard of startup CEOs and not necessarily growth CEOs or not necessarily like long-term CEOs. Like it's a different skill set.
Yes.
Like he loved the product. He loves the product and wanted to build it from nothing and do this. And it's like, you know, he didn't want to do the day-to-day management stuff.
Right.
Like,
yeah. And Sebastian De Guy on over an Algorithmic when they got acquired by Adobe. I mean, I've heard some people just go like, this is, well, they're selling out. It's all going to be, you know, they can't, they're going to be, now it's all going to be subscription pricing. It's going to be terrible. And I'm like, don't assume that necessarily.
Yeah, first, don't assume it. Like, you know, like Arnold has subscription pricing. They haven't transitioned all the pricing away from how their old model was.
Sure.
And also like the benefits, besides everybody getting a new shiny computer, beside that, they're able to hire more engineers. Like the Arnold GPU renderer wouldn't be there.
Right.
If it wasn't for Autodesk saying like from day one, here's two more headcount to focus on GPU.
Right.
And I mean, we hired them within like months.
Right. Interesting. So what's your thoughts about the Redshift acquisition?
I mean, first, great for them.
Yeah.
Great for Redshift. Right. It is hard to build a company and it's good to be able to recognize some of that. It's also great if they had interest in expanding broader than they ever could based off of their own revenue base.
Right.
I think it's an interesting time. Like Cinema 4D was itself the management was actually bought out, right?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So like they owned a large portion of it and then somebody came in. I think it might've just been a company that had part of it and bought much more of it.
Okay.
Right. And whenever you're doing that, whenever you're investing in a company, like actually, you can think about, you trace the public stuff for the foundry because they've gone through this so many times.
Yeah. So they just went through it again.
They just went through it again.
And, right? Although that's not like, it didn't really make the news. They kept it under the radar that they just got reacquired.
Well, it made my news.
Right. Yeah.
It made my news. And also it's because it's a different type of acquisition this time.
Mm-hmm.
Getting acquired by a private equity company. Private equity companies are usually looking for, I want 3 to 5x of my 3 to 5x return within 3 to 5 years. That's a good deal for them, right? And so you can look at the foundry and from Falcon Investments to, first Windcrest, I guess, and then Falcon, and then Carlyle, and then HG, and now the new one.
Right.
The new one's actually not private equity. It's a privately held. It's their own company.
Right.
Which is great for them because there's, you know, you get acquired, hooray. And then you've got this 3 to 5 year timeline in order to try and boost revenue.
Right.
Right. Because because everything on in terms of a company's worth is based off of revenue or expected revenue.
Right.
Right. So when you come into not just a startup that, you know, that hockey stick of growth starts to slow down, it's more like, how do we increase our revenue? Like, so how does the foundry increase their revenue when Nuke already dominates the market?
Right.
You got to acquire other companies that have revenue.
Right. Got it.
Right. So then all of a sudden, oh, this company used to be I'm making these numbers up.
Right.
This company used to be making 40 million pounds a year and they acquire a company that's making 10 million pounds a year. So now the combined company is making 50 million in revenue.
Right.
Like Nuke could have never gained 20% overnight, but that's a way that the company can gain. And so you can look at that for your Cinema 4D. How are you expanding the value of this? You acquire other revenue.
Right.
Right. I mean, you could look at some. Okay, well,
that makes sense.
Yeah, Dirty Laundry kind of stuff. Like when Digital Main was originally acquired, like it was this reverse IPO thing on the Hong Kong stock market, and combined with some companies that were like solar panels and scrap metal and stuff like that.
Yep.
Like nothing related to it, but they were generating revenue.
Right.
So you could hide a bunch of the negative loss of the visual effects company. Like, well, this company's generating revenue, so here's 10 million from this, and combined with the negative 10 million in DD, hey, we're not losing.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
So that's.
It's interesting. That makes sense because basically Maxon, in order to grow, they had to acquire new business, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they did. Do you think that's going to change? I mean, because a lot of people are like, well, why would they acquire Redshift just to try to put it into Maxon? Or maybe not even necessarily, does it matter?
No, I mean, it's part of it's just revenue, right? Like Autodesk has not stopped Arnold support for any other product at all.
Right.
Quite the opposite, right? Yeah. So, Fred, who's the Frederick Servant, who's the manager of the team, used to be the Houdini to Arnold guy.
Right.
When he, as he elevated, they hired somebody to backfill him.
Right.
They didn't have to, but they did because like, look, that's, that's revenue. Like, why would I give up revenue?
Why would I give up revenue? Yeah.
Yeah. And so I like all those fears of people saying, oh, Maxon is going to shut down Red, or Redshift is going to be shut down for any other products besides Synod 4D. I think that's very short-sighted. A company to do like it's,
but
not,
it's interesting. Okay, the only thing that was kind of puzzling to me, because obviously you try to shoehorn like how do these two products fit together, and the case you're making is they don't need to, but I was like, Redshift is a completely 100% GPU renderer, right? Mm-hmm. And it's completely, as of now at least, they completely 100% rely on CUDA code, which only runs on NVIDIA cards, and Maxon is a very heavily Macintosh user base, which does not have NVIDIA cards. So,
except for the externals, right?
Except for the externals, but that's not enough. You know, like that, you have to convince someone to do that extra step. And it's like, you're not going to go, ooh, I like Cinema 4D. You know what? I'm just going to add Redshift. Not going to work on your MacBook Pro. You know what I mean? So it was interesting. I was like, how is that going to work? And then I realized like, oh, now that you put it in perspective, that's actually something interesting to think
about. There's that. And also like, hey, if it's Redshift, like, hey, we don't want to be completely exclusive on CUDA code, but we don't have the bandwidth or the engineering resource just to switch it out to OpenCL, right? Maybe now they do.
Yeah, we've done it for both. I can tell you, it's can be tricky.
Yeah. It's GPU is really hard to write.
Is very hard to write. We've been writing it since 2008, so it's been around for a long time.
I know. You popped on a lot of different horses there.
Yeah, I think when we first wrote the first version of V-Ray on the GPU, CUDA was not around yet, so we sort of shoehorned our code into a shader, which is the hackiest way possible to write a ray tracer, is to shoehorn it into a shader. But anyway.
Yeah, you guys were one of the only people besides DreamWorks to support MetaSL. You remember that thing?
Yeah.
Right? And
we support it.
Whoever's paying the bills, right?
OSL now, all that other stuff. Yeah. MetaSL was, that was Mental Ray, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. We supported that for a while. It was weird. Anyway, so we're going to go on a several tangents as we go down the road here. But so you're still at New York, and you're working at New York, and you were consulting obviously on the Arnold thing.
Consulted for them. I consulted for a couple of companies on the West Coast. I consulted for Nimble Collective, which is this amazing animation pipeline in the cloud.
Oh, really?
Based out of Northern California, based out of a bunch of former PDI DreamWorkers.
Yeah. What was it? Sorry. What was it called?
Nimble Collective.
I remember them. Super cool
still
people.
On.
Yeah. I remember them contacting me, right?
Yeah.
Really cool guys. So they basically, the whole idea is they virtualize an entire machine for you, right?
They virtualize the entire machine, and it's really, they're not trying to build animation software, but it's the pipeline aspect of it, right?
Right.
So, and the pipeline ends up being a lot around asset management and asset tracking. And not even task tracking, because, you know, like, why would you try and build that yourself instead of just integrating with Shotgun?
Right.
Not trying to build a renderer yourself, integrating with every renderer.
Right. So when you log into your VM, basically it's all set up for you. You're ready to go, and you've got an entire pipeline at your fingertips, done.
I think the value add there, the interesting thing for them was, unlike a proprietary cloud, with all due respect to the V-Ray cloud, like, mm-hmm. unlike that, like, they're Switzerland, right? They're not. Right. They're not in the business of trying to, like, you know, with Foundry's Athera and whatever Autodesk is doing,
right?
Like, is Foundry gonna run Maya on their cloud? Is Autodesk gonna let them do that, and vice versa?
Right.
Like, it's this mutual assured destruction kind of thing,
right?
Whereas, like, they literally are Switzerland. Like, hey, we're not building software. We're just building a pipeline,
right?
And you can still have relationships with your customers. We're gonna allow them to bring their own licenses onto our platform.
Right.
So it's almost like, it's almost like a, have you ever heard the term VAR, value added reseller?
No.
So like resellers, like RFX are like they're called value added resellers. And
have a lot of them.
A lot of the value added back in the old generation was, oh, we'll host your mini conference here and locally in town and stuff like that. And we'll do a bunch of advertising and do the local sales, handle all those license installs for you locally in Japanese and do all that stuff. Right?
That's how we work with our resellers.
Yeah. So if you think about this is a next generation VAR, right? The value add is we're providing a pipeline,
mm-hmm.
right? On top of, like, you know, people are still paying for the VM. itself. People are still paying the cloud provider for the VM. They're still paying the software provider for the license.
Right.
But we're adding this value of making it easy for them to use and set up. And so essentially they're reselling some of these things.
Sure.
But in a different way. Right.
Right.
So rather than hosting conferences and stuff like that, there the value add is, hey, we're integrated all into a pipeline for you.
Interesting. Well, what is your thoughts? Because, you know, since we last talked, I mean, you and I, you know, it's interesting because it wasn't that many years ago. It was a couple of years ago we talked, and it was still a struggle for a lot of the industry to think about doing things on the cloud, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Nowadays, it seems like everyone is doing some form of cloud, whether it is actually like a more formal Azure or Deadline through Amazon or Google. Obviously, we use Google via Chaos Cloud. But like all of now, it seems like everyone is using. No one's got a computer at their desk anymore. It's all remote access in some way.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think the opportunity is now opened up to do that.
Right.
Right. So
the skepticism is gone.
Well, it's two things. First, skepticism. Second, prices have come down a bit. And then I think, props to Adrian Graham. He made this really amazing presentation at one of the Google conferences.
GCP talking was, about, yeah.
Yeah. And he just talked about, look, yes, if you had this VM running 24/7, like 365 days a year, it's more expensive than you just buying the damn workstation.
Right. But it's like, sitting, if it's just sitting there doing nothing.
Yeah, but when the artist goes home, you just turn it off, you don't pay. Or when the artist is checking email for an hour in the morning, you don't need the GPU. Like, don't get that instance. And,
right.
Like, you know, there's still some steps to get there.
Right.
And also, you kind of assume that all your data has to be in the cloud for that to be useful.
Right.
But, yeah, what a compelling argument. And that actually can help make those prices drop compared to, I mean, price and security have been the two biggest barriers.
Right.
And that's one way to find the way to for prices to drop. The other way is just over time. You've never seen the cost of S3 storage go up over years. It's always going down and down and down.
Right.
It's always to the bottom, essentially.
Or you get upgrades that are significantly better at the same price.
Right.
And
those
upgrade cycles are significantly faster than you can afford to buy a new computer at your own on-prem, right?
Yeah.
So how did the industry manage to convince the big companies, the Marvels and all those guys – to be able to say, hey, or the NPA for that matter, to say, okay, it's okay to render on the cloud? Because that was something that everyone used to say a couple of years ago. They used to say, there's no way we can do it. It will never pass Marvel. It'll never pass NPAA. No one will ever do it. We can never use the cloud. Cloud will never happen. And then, of course, they're wrong.
Yeah. I think it's so a lot has changed. So this, I now work at Animal Logic. Mm-hmm. This is the first time first time I come back to an actual vendor, a visual effects or animated film vendor, right? Producing content instead of producing software for content since I left Method in 2012, right?
Right.
or 2013. And back in the 2012, 2013 days, that was the days of the MPAA plus Marvel plus Sean Flynn, like changing the entire landscape of security saying, no, air-gapped you can't work on our films.
Right. Right.
And air-gapped means you have no direct connection to the internet at your desktop, where our special content is, where the next reveal of the next Iron Man suit is, there's no way that can get to the internet.
Right.
And so that was it was a really dark time for the industry. And it was actually I was kind of glad to be, to step out for a while and not have to suffer from some of those great lockdowns. Again, two things have happened. One, the two barriers for cloud were cost and security.
Right.
And so for render farms and rendering, like if you can establish a direct connection or a completely VPN connection to cloud, it's no different than me having a data center in a different location. And I have a big pipe connecting where all the artists are to the data center.
Right? Sure.
And so, and really the cloud is no different. Cloud rendering is no different than that. If you've reserved instances, it's almost like a private cloud.
Right? That's yeah, yeah.
So that was the first one that fell.
So you had to convince the studios that was the case, right?
Yeah, and so you can say, here, this is how I'm using it, And by the way, and it's always about, and for the studios, most of it is all cost, right? Because these films are very expensive to produce. Anything they can do in order to make it cost less, which is whether it's rebates or rebates or incentives or anything like that, or just lowering the cost of operations, they're actually in favor of, as long as somebody passes off on it.
Right, but it was also a matter of risk, right? Because they wanted to make sure that there was no risk of any leaks or anything else, because then that would lower the value of their property, right?
Right, exactly, right. There's this idea, I remember the Disney auditors, and I'm sure it came from Marvel back in the day, like they said, look, we're giving you $200 million in a briefcase. This film, ultimately, with advertising, marketing, everything, well, not just the base cost of the film, but like marketing, everything, it's $200 million. We're giving it to you in a briefcase where you could actually distribute it, or, you know, if you lost that briefcase, we're out $200 million,
right?
Plus the expected revenue. So that's why they treated this as so secure, right? The cloud itself, I mean, you know, our Department of Defense runs on the cloud, right? Like all of our HIPAA information, all of our medical information is on the cloud. All credit card transactions on the cloud. It's actually safe as long as you do it correctly. And so I think some of those initial barriers were this idea of, if all it is just there's a big pipe between my facility and a bunch of render nodes, and they happen to be Google render nodes versus my own render nodes that I've purchased
in
a different data center, there's no difference there. And you just had to get approval from the studio.
The same deal.
Hey, I can either do this or I can charge you more because I have to buy these or rent these and build them on premise and figure out where to put them and pay for the air conditioning and power.
Right.
And they would get buy off on that.
It almost seems like in the audit, if you think about it in the audit situation, it'd be simpler to say, all of our stuff is going to Google. You've already, I'm using Google as an example, but you can use AWS or Azure or whatever you want to use. But let's say it's Google, and they say, all of our stuff is going to Google. So therefore, you've already audited Google. So all you need to audit is from Google to here, right?
Yeah.
And that's it. And that simplifies the process, right?
That's where we're getting to.
Right.
And so the other thing that, so we've talked about cost a lot, we've kind of touched on security, but the difference here is like, is between, so a lot of people in technology are very familiar with this, but for the general audience, everybody knows about the MPAA because that's the people that put the ratings in the films.
Right.
They've been responsible for content security for years, right? So they were responsible for all the audits. And then what happened is recently the MPAA, use a bunch of acronyms on this. MPAA merged with the CDSA, Cloud Digital Security Alliance, I think, and then created this thing called the TPN, the Trusted Partner Network.
Okay.
And two major things that are changed about that. The first one is that was the way when it was under the MPAA, all the studios paid for all the audits for all the vendors.
Right.
So like, hey, you're going to come in and audit us. You're paying for the cost of the auditor and the audit travel and everything like that. And then we open our kimono and then you get the report.
Right.
With the TPN, we have to pay for the audits. So, great way to reduce cost.
Yeah.
Right. But then the promise is this is the one true audit. Like I can't remember how many audits I went through in the year and a half that I was at Method from the different studios saying,
yeah,
I don't necessarily trust the MPAA audit. So we're going to do our own audit in addition to whatever the MPAA would do. Right. So we had many, many audits and one for each location. So it's like a N by N, N squared problem, right?
Right.
This is one audit per location per year.
Right.
Right. And this will cover everybody, we promise, this time, every studio that's part of the MPAA.
Wow.
So there's that. And then the other thing that's changed from MPAA to TPN is that the TPN has embraced, you have a lot of people that are involved in the TPN that are, that are from outside of our industry,
right?
That have experienced security, tight cloud-based security outside of our industry.
Okay,
right. And so it's opened up a lot of great opportunities. So I'm super glad to have come back to the industry, come back to being in a production studio right when this is happening, because it means that we can change a lot of our methodologies to be more embracive of the way that the rest of the world works.
Right? Okay.
Like, so you can access your email from wherever the heck you want on your phone, right? You can access Google Drive or any of those kind of things.
Yep.
And that's part of how you work. Like Slack, you're getting Slack messages at lunch and whatever, and sending back and forth. Like, but you can't do that in the current MPAA guidelines and environment.
Right.
So,
yep.
So what does that
mean? Can't check my renders.
Does that mean that you're like, that you're still at your desk every day for every second. Right. No, you're still around. You still go out to lunch.
Right.
It just means that you're actually less effective and less efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Some people will like, you can't use a messaging app internal to the company to communicate back and forth. They're like, hey, come to dailies or something like that on your phone. Right. So people find ways around it. They start using WhatsApp to do the same thing, which is even worse because it's like, that's not controlled by us.
Right.
Right.
It used to happen all the time.
Yeah. There's that line from Jurassic Park, that nature will find a way.
Yeah.
Like nature will find a way. Like I'm mobile. I think like at this point, well over 70% of all internet traffic is from mobile devices.
70%. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. I think in 2017, it was like 65. So I'm just extrapolating. It's probably higher.
Yep.
Right. Like, so, and the idea that we can't do any of our work, even some of the ancillary administrative work from our mobile devices, kind of crazy in this day and age.
Yeah. Right?
And I had this, you know, I worked at this internet startup in New York, and I had that flexibility. Like, you know, we were tight. We had SOC 2 Type 2 compliance, which is a form, like the MPA was originally based off of some of that stuff.
Yep.
But we were able to do all these things, right? I could work from home just as easily as I'm working from the office, just as easily as when I go visit our developers in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I could do anything I needed to from wherever I was. And so I became much more efficient.
Right.
And I think the people at TPN have started to recognize that and started to try and embrace some of these workflows. And, you know, a lot of what we do in our industry is really playing catch up with the rest of the world.
Right.
And you can look at the security models that have been adopted by the major tech corporations. Like Google actually came out with this thing called BeyondCorp.
Okay.
And BeyondCorp is really, it was influenced by a hack, I think, that happened in 2014 called Operation Aurora. Bunch of nation state Chinese hackers hacked in and got through Google.
Interesting.
Got into Google, got in, not just Google, a lot of other majors, right? And it was because they had done the same.
What year was this about?
I think in 2014.
Okay.
I think. Google it.
Right. And
they had the same kind of security model that we've all had for a while. Here's a big, thick firewall around the outside of our studio.
Right.
And then once you're in, you're in. You can do whatever you need to do.
Right.
And so people got in. Got access to stuff at Google, and they said, wait a second, maybe we need to change how we're approaching security.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe instead of assuming once you're in, or assuming some level
that
of
you
trust,
got in there legitimately.
Yeah. Let's assume zero trust. Let's assume that all access has to be from beyond the corporate network.
Right.
And enable access from beyond the corporate network. This is an acknowledgement of two things. One is that's not like just having a big wall.
Mm-hmm.
A wall doesn't actually protect you. Tell Donald Trump, right?
Right. Yeah.
Just having a big wall is not the right security. The right security is to establish trust. Establish trust through a variety of different variables, right?
Okay.
Username and password, multi-factor authentication. Is Chris Nichols actually accessing data from here in Culver City at the same time that he's actually physically in China? No. So block one or the other.
Right.
Your choice. Establish it, principle behind BeyondCorp is this thing called zero trust principle, which is like, I trust nobody until I get signals from them telling them that I should trust them and only trust them to a certain amount. So I can say, like, if Chris is on our corporate network and he's done all these other things, then he has access to all of this stuff. But if he's not, if he's sitting at home, then we don't give him access to this thing.
Right.
Right. It's all about establishing that trust based off of role and different signals.
I think it's interesting because people are like the point of the trust situation has gotten so big now that the industry is moving beyond passwords, mm-hmm. right? Passwords are actually really bad because it turns out people have really bad passwords.
Yeah.
They're very easy to figure out.
I think that's a password actually, is a really bad password.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I remember some story about some guy who was like, you know, a consultant to go to see the security of a company. And he pretty much figured out, like, there was three ways he got it. First thing he did is he typed in password as a password. Mm-hmm. Turns out that worked like 35% of the time or something ridiculous amount. The other one is he would lift a keyboard and he would see the password written on the bottom of the keyboard. That's another common way to find it. And the third one he did is he dumped a bunch of USB sticks in the parking lot and people put them into their computers at work.
Yeah.
It's amazing how stupid people can be.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean to say that condescending way, but it's like that's how easy. So like the authentication in a way that only – there's no other way it could be you.
Right.
Right?
Right.
That's
kind of the idea. Right. That's the idea behind this zero trust principle.
Right.
And then also the other piece of BeyondCorp is this acknowledgement that Google has people remote working all the time.
Sure.
the only way that you can make sure that they're as secure as the people within the you know, within the confines of your headquarters, your offices, is to assume that zero trust and only establish that over with different criteria.
Right.
Right. So I think that's a principle that, I mean, the TPN transition is still happening. Audits are starting happening. TPN audits for cloud or TPN certification for cloud providers itself probably won't happen until next year.
Sure.
But they're all moving towards this idea of when this happens, we've done everything to be approved.
Right, 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 right.
So I think it's a really, I mean, as exciting as content security can be,
yeah,
it's a really exciting time for that because we're looking at the problem and finding a different solution that actually helps. We work with this company called Independent Security Evaluators. Most, a lot of people do.
Okay.
They're amazing and they focus a lot on our industry.
Sure.
Make a lot of presentations and, their idea is that security is there to support the workflow, not the other way around.
Got it.
Right. So if your workflow is, I need to be able, like as a coordinator, I need to be able to roam around and get a text message.
Right.
Saying, hey, come to daily. Is there this person's out sick? Or, you know, managing that. Like I need to be able to do that. And we just need to figure out the right security model to make sure that's done in a secure way.
And also an easy way.
Yeah.
Right. Because sometimes I remember, you know, like you said, that in the dark ages, it seems so hacky to try to do something that should really be really simple.
Yeah.
Just to be able to get over that security concern.
I should not have to sign into a VPN from my laptop just to be able to get access to my email or something like that.
That's
or,
what people did.
Or Shotgun or any of these different things.
Right.
So.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, you're going to see a lot of stuff change over the next year and a half. Certainly we're changing a lot of Anima Logic. To be able to first change that security model so we can embrace a lot more raw cloud services like Render and we're actually moving our backups, our daily backups offsite.
To
like, you know, Tape Robot, like one of the things, if you look at the stuff like, oh, a Tape Robot, so I'm creating a tape, it's still on site. So from a disaster recovery's perspective, that tape backup has to now be pushed offsite. So now but I still need to be able to access it fast. So I do create double backups. Like I create one backup and then I make a backup of that backup and then I put that backup offsite. All this stuff. Whereas if I was just backing it up to the cloud, every cloud storage thing is three regions secured at least.
And
three
redundant.
Copies. Yeah. Three copies and highly accessible.
Yeah.
So I can literally
access it just as easily as you put it there.
Yeah. So I can literally do it better, faster, and cheaper if I'm doing my backup to the cloud.
Right.
In a secure way.
Well, that's awesome. Okay. I do want to talk briefly about your new role at Anima Logic, but we got a lot more we want to cover. So hopefully you have some time. So you started recently. It's like August. And you're now the CTO of Anima Logic.
Yeah, the group CTO of Anima Logic.
Okay. And Anima Logic obviously has been around for a long time.
Yeah, 1991, so 28 years.
28 years.
In Sydney. Different areas. Started out in Crow's Nest, and now we're on the Fox Studios lot. They haven't changed the name.
Right.
Disney Studios lot yet. I don't think they changed the name, but on the Fox lot in Sydney.
Okay. The Fox lot in Sydney, right.
Yeah.
But there's something, you know, obviously Anima Logic is really well known for obviously fantastic commercial work that it's known for a long time, episodic work as well. They did a bunch of work on Game of Thrones stuff, right?
I don't think so.
We
first came on the scene with this movie called The Matrix.
Yes.
We did a bunch of work on that original movie and then the sequels. It's been interesting from an animation perspective. We've been able to be at some really kind of pivotal points over the course of animation, which the company I've just started, but the company is very proud of. Right, so Happy Feet, first animated film
did
motion motion capture
won the
Academy Award when it seemed like a destined for a Pixar DreamWorks only kind of thing. Right,
right.
So won the Academy Award there for Happy Feet. Then we did this movie called Legend of the Guardians or Guardians of Ga'Hoole, depending on where you saw it.
Right.
A Zack Snyder movie about everybody was like, oh, the owl movie. Right?
Yes.
It was stunning visually.
Yes, it was.
Stunning visually. Like, we'll leave the other stuff to the users, to the listener's imagination. But visually, it was really kind of hyper photorealistic, like in that Zack Snyder style, but as an animated film.
Yep.
Right. Really kind of set the bar. I remember being at DreamWorks and getting sent to go look at
yeah,
it.
Yeah, the pictures of the feathers on that owl, I remember very, yeah. like the slow motion, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Yep. Changed a little bit about how people think about animated films and how you can incorporate visual effects mentalities in animated films.
Right.
And then we were blessed enough to work on this Lego movie. Right. Lego movie, which you're not, again, like, you know, as an outsider looking at it, so I can gloat about it. Like, what an amazing idea. I mean, great concept from, yep. from Lord and Miller. But then just like kind of the visual style and approach was unique and different. And you yeah. can see like Lord and Miller have just done the same thing with Spider-Man.
Right.
Right. In the multiverse. And like, you know, we're kind of like, wow, that they have set a new bar. They did something else different and unique.
Yep.
We wish we would have been a part of it. Like, but that's the kind of thing that we love to be a part of. And so, yeah, we've been doing that kind of stuff for many, many years. And then a few years ago, or actually 4 years ago now, mm-hmm. Warner Brothers approached to say, hey, we want more content out of you guys. Why don't you build a studio in Vancouver?
Uh-huh.
So we built a studio from scratch in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And actually the Lego Movie 2 was predominantly produced out of Vancouver.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay. Yeah, it came out earlier this year. So that was their first animated film. They're working on their second animated film now.
Right.
Out of a 3-picture exclusive deal with Warner Brothers. And so, yeah, so you have the runway of 3 pictures. You know that you're safe enough to build a brick and mortar somewhere. Right.
But it's pretty cool that they let, you know, that you get to stay here in California. You obviously have some roots here that you need to maintain, but you're able, they seem like a really cool and flexible company that allow you to do that. Obviously you must be traveling a lot. But.
I travel a lot.
Right.
And, it is, I had some personal things happen where, required us to be in Los Angeles.
Right.
And originally we were planning on moving to Sydney.
Right.
And explained the situation. And my boss, CEO Zari Nalbandian, said, mm-hmm. well, you're the right person for the job and you really want this job. So let's just figure out a way to make it work. And, you know, to hear somebody say that, your boss say that, like, I'm going to go to the ends of the earth for this guy.
Yeah. That's great.
And so, yeah, I literally have. I've traveled quite a lot. We're comparing mileage stories.
Literally at the other end of the earth.
Yeah.
It's awesome to do that. And it's really great to see a company. Like I said, 28 years has been in the business and it still, you know, maintains a good personal relationship with people. So,
yeah. One thing that I think, I just talked about the creative history of the company. Mm-hmm. Something that Zari, our CEO, said, which really stuck with me is, first, our motto, our company motto is create great work with great people.
Right.
And we really hold that up to a high standard. Like from our company culture and everything, it's very much about the people and creating great work.
Sure.
And so he's said, look, over 28 years, we've had some up and down years financially, uh-huh. but we've never had a bad year creatively.
Okay.
And that's the principle that we operate on. And that's, it's just amazing to work for a company that holds that so highly.
That's great. That's awesome. That's awesome. So I do want to talk a little bit about somebody. I mean, you mentioned obviously briefly mentioned you were part of VS. We talked earlier about you being part of the SciTech Awards, but you've been involved in the technology relationship or different organizations and nonprofits of the industry forever, right?
Yeah.
SIGGRAPH, you're obviously a big part of SIGGRAPH. You're on the board at SIGGRAPH, I'm assuming.
No, I was a computer animation festival juror this year. I've been participating.
Wow.
You mentioned Doug Robel before. Doug jumped me into the SciTech process. He pulled me into SIGGRAPH early on as well. I started participating in 2001.
Right.
I was very active for a number of years. Ran the computer animation festival in 2003.
Right.
So it was really nice to be able to come back.
Right.
To that, see how that process has changed. See, just the work is just amazing. And it's actually, maybe it's from some of the focus and like things, but like you see actually more amazing student work now than you even see from the studios.
Right.
Right. Really kind of really shockingly good student work. And
what do you think is the cause? Do you think that basically like the off the shelf software has sort of liberated a lot of the creativity in a lot of ways?
I think it has, although if I look, I have this great, like, what is this, the 2019 to 2003, so 16-year span of looking at the content. Students are still great storytellers, and they're actually able to tell a story from their own perspective.
Right.
Right? like soup to nuts, not there's no studio executive coming in and saying, put a fart joke in here or anything like that. It's like, here's their story. And sometimes that can be not quite so successful.
Sure.
But other times it can be just amazing because it's a single person's point of view and you can see something like, you know, a lot of great films were first time auteurs, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Doing stuff. And so you see a real sense of, a real vision and a real message behind these films. I can't talk about the award winners this year, but you're, bring some tissue.
Yeah.
Okay. Bring some tissue, some real heartfelt things. And just, but from a visual aspect, yes. I think it's a combination of both the software in the industry and the barrier to entry getting lower to produce high quality work.
Yep.
Right? I mean, you've seen GI blow up obviously in the last decade. But then also it's the schools. You see consistent, amazing work from certain schools year after year, right? Film Academy in Battenberg, SuperInfocom, Gobelin.
Oh, SuperInfocom is amazing.
Le Gobelin.
Yeah.
And there's even new ones that I, like, you know, 16 years ago weren't there, and I'm looking like, wait, who the hell are these people? I got to go recruit out of this
Film
company.
Academy. And
Film Academy. There's a place called Art VFX, which is doing more VFX focused work instead of animated films, like just kind of that I'd never heard of. It's in Montpellier.
Yeah.
It's all French, but yeah.
Which is great. So, when I said, you know, is it, do you think the software has helped liberating them? I meant that mostly in the fact that I think people are not bogged down by the technology anymore, right? I think that somehow the technology has sort of become less of the primary conversation and that they can basically focus on the creativity in some ways.
Well, yeah. I mean, just thinking about rendering and, you know, with Chaos Group, we should talk about rendering too. Like, look, think about what GI has done. Like, how much of an expert did you have to do all these hacky things in RenderMan back in the day? RenderMan now is amazing. RenderMan back in the day, in order to get a good looking image out, because you couldn't afford the processing time to do a full GI solution.
Right. And so you had to fake it all. Yeah.
Yeah. And so once you do that, once you have, here's a standardized shader.
Right.
Right. And you can turn all the knobs. And so you can focus on the creative aspects versus the technical aspects. It's enabling a whole bunch of, you know, you used to have to have people that were super technical as well as creative producing this content. And now you can have just creative people. So it opens up the base of who can produce much, much broader.
Right. I mean, it's just a couple of stories. One is I remember listening to a interview with Jeff Bridges during Tron.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking, it was on a radio or a podcast, I don't remember, but someone says, well, what is it like, you know, what do you think about working with a first-time director like Joe Kaczynski? He goes, I love working with first-time directors. They're the best kind of directors. It's like Citizen Kane is made by a first-time director, right? So I think that there's important things that if, you know, a fresh mind that's uncorrupted by the system can actually have some really interesting ideas.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important part of the process. But yeah, you know, I'm thinking about now, like I've seen some people who are lighters, right? Who basically are not bogged down by all of those things anymore. You mentioned RenderMan, right? And I mean, like you said, RenderMan is very different now than it was back when I was using it. But we did have to do a lot of hacky things. Now we did use some level of ray tracing, but it was always like, to supplement it. So it was just, it felt like a hack on top of a hack on top of a hack.
Yeah.
Now that when you go full ray tracing, which is very different, it's a little bit that. But what's so weird now is that, you know, in the real time world, now you're starting to see ray tracing appear in the real time world.
Yeah.
But it's the way that most of the time it's being done is it's the same hacky way that we're doing it before.
Well, because they're doing it in a 60th of a second, right?
I know that that's the limitation and that, therefore that's why that's what it is. But it is still cumbersome.
Yeah.
That, I mean, we're focusing on full real-time ray tracing. So 100% ray tracing.
But
that's challenging.
Yeah. I think the really interesting thing is when some of that stuff, because they'll find efficiencies that we never found.
Sure.
Right. And bring it back in. Like, you know, there was ambient occlusion, like Hayden Landis, all these.
I hate ambient occlusion.
Yeah. Well, I know, but it was a thing.
Yeah, it was a
right?
thing.
Actually beautiful because it was the first name on that award for the SciTech Award. Yeah. He's an artist. He couldn't code worth a damn, but he just like, I want something that creates that darkness around the corners that I see everywhere.
Right.
Right. And then, you know, some other people coded it up.
Right.
In like a couple hours and there you go.
Right.
Right. But I was thinking about ambient occlusion and then, I think really games in real time introduced screen space animated collision.
Right.
And then we use that stuff for viewports and stuff now all the time within our industry. So there's, when you see that cycle back, it's like, hey, create something new and innovative, right? And but then like somebody figuring out how to optimize it even better. There are people that are great at optimization.
Sure.
That aren't creating something new, but can make something work 10 times faster. And so I love seeing that. I love seeing that convergence, or seeing things feed back in from games or real time to our processes today.
Okay.
And you see some of that now, like in some of the approaches for, and maybe it's all just Max Leone. Max Leone started out at Animal Logic. He wrote Glimpse, our render, which, and then he left to go work on that RenderMan thing.
Right.
And in both cases, there's this philosophy, this idea of render everywhere now, and RenderMan stuff, it's been RenderMan everywhere.
Right.
And it's this idea of, look, if we can make this easy enough to use, like there's not a bunch of stuff that you're having to configure, we can make it so that you can access this render at any point in the pipeline, or you can use this renderer at any point in the pipeline.
Sure.
So, you know, on Peter Rabbit, we had our animation dailies were all fully furred, fully lit. Right. So the animators, and what that does is, besides, obviously you get a better sense of what that animation would actually be finally.
Right.
It also helped fix a bunch of the, like, you were a lighter, like how much of your time was spent fixing other people's broken stuff that came to you.
That's most of what we did.
It's most of what you did. Right. The animator, or the person, the TD helping the animator,
right,
can see that stuff and fix it at that point.
Instead of down the line.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you're doing a little bit of tweaking as a lighter now, but most of that heavy lifting of just fixing broken stuff now happens up the pipeline.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
Definitely good. Okay. Speaking of software, I want to talk briefly about the Academy Software Foundation.
Sure. Yeah.
So this was last year, 2 years ago? When was it announced? Last year, I think.
Last year.
Yeah. Last year. And okay, why don't you, you'll do a better job than I will. So tell people what the ASWF is.
Academy Software Foundation came out of a long-term effort between the Academy, between various members of the community, looking at a number of the free, libre, open-source projects, open-source software projects that were out there, and that had wide adoption. Initially, the focus was like, had wide adoption and had been kind of orphaned. Right. You look at these things like OpenVDB, there's Ken Musseth, it left DreamWorks, was at Weta, had a side hustle at SpaceX, like not enough time to support it himself. And, and for all the stuff that you want to continue to push forward. Jeremy Salon with OpenColor.io had been working at Valve for forever. So he wasn't focused on color as much as he did back in the day, even though he's a color scientist. You know, OpenXR, we knew like Florian, like this is the brain drain. Florian went to Google.
Right.
Right. And then so it was like, okay, who's supporting and maintaining this after Florian's gone? So there was this real kind of crisis of like, these are critical to our industry, critical to how we do our business.
Right.
But there's no support. There's no way to really truly support these things.
Right.
So let's figure out a way to do that. And that's where the Academy Software Foundation, I think, I'm trying to remember what the original name was, but it luckily the Academy, this is the only external foundation that's ever gotten the Academy's name on it.
Interesting.
Right. So, because it was that important to them, that's how the Academy Software Foundation was born, out of lots of effort from various different people from VS and the Academy to figure this thing out. And so that was, you know, a lot of people think of that as that's what this is. It's where important open source projects go to live after they've almost died.
Sure.
And certainly that's a big part of it. And that's why you see the first projects that have gotten in are OpenVDB, OpenColor.io. Mm-hmm. I think by the time of this podcast, it'll have been announced that OpenEXR, there was a bunch of trademark licensing stuff to sort through. OpenEXR is now part of that. And so you'll see those things and like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And
being part of the foundation, there's sort of a pledge to maintain the software, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, first, you don't have to be a member in order to benefit from the software. Just to be clear, the whole thing
it's still open source.
Yeah, it's still open source.
Right.
However, so Animal Logic was one of the premier, is a premier level member and one of the founding members of this foundation. A number of other great companies have done that as well. Not just content producers, but also like Intel, NVIDIA. because they
I think
want
Google's
to make sure.
Also a member
Google's
too.
A member okay. as well.
Yeah.
Because they see this as important to helping out this industry. Mm-hmm. And because as a member, you start to get voting rights. Mm-hmm. You start to help steer the direction of this stuff.
Right.
Right. So, and we are actively looking for paid members.
Right.
And there's different levels, like, you know, open source software, like, Blender is joined mm-hmm. at a different level than the Premiere level, things right. like that. Right. So that you have a voice, you have a vote, you can participate in the future direction of open source software for our industry.
Right.
So yes, the idea is how do we make sure that these things exist and continue to exist and thrive? Mm-hmm. Also the idea of how do we make sure that it's more accessible? Like, so if it's something that's coming from a large scale, visual effects or animation company, mm-hmm. odds are it compiles well on Linux. And maybe it compiles on Windows or Mac, whatever laptop the developers are using. Mm-hmm. but that's not the primary. The primary has been Linux. Right. So how do we have this CI/CD environment mm-hmm. So that we can do those builds? And how, like, you don't have to be an industry expert in order to get OpenXR building on Windows, right? We can have people from the this is all under the auspice of the Linux Foundation.
Okay.
So how do we have people that are used to having build environments that can build across multiple platforms.
Multiple platforms, yeah.
How do we incorporate that so that all these things can exist on all multiple platforms? So again, it becomes more accessible to everybody.
Yeah.
So there's that as a key aspect. And then the other thing, so another project has just been accepted into incubation. So it's important that there's different steps. There's incubation, like we think that this is an interesting thing, and then you have to go through some more steps in order to be actually accepted.
Yep.
As a project. And then I think then we also allow the chance that if, hey, this was accepted and we use this for a while, but it's no longer useful, then it goes into archived.
Okay.
For incubation, it's just you accept projects in there and you want to actually encourage. There's great examples of projects out there that aren't developed by a large scale studio that had the manpower, that had the resources in order to build it out, in order to promote it, to have luncheons at SIGGRAPH to say, hey, everybody come here, look at our stuff. Isn't this cool? Please adopt it.
Right.
That could be very important to the industry, but maybe aren't as funded as much as some of these other projects have
sure.
been. And so the first example of that is OpenQ, which is Google took over. There's Q3 developed by Matt Chambers and lots of others after Matt left mm-hmm. at Sony ImageWorks a long time ago. Sony gave it to Google in order to make it an open source project. Mm-hmm. Not tied to Google at all. It's mm-hmm. just Google supporting and maintaining it to mm-hmm. provide a free open source render scheduler
okay.
to the industry, right? Yeah, Sony's used the previous version of it, but nobody's used this new version. I mean, there's some studios that have been using it as a trial, but it's actually just released, and then they're now at incubation in the Academy Software Foundation
right.
already. So a lot of people go, wait, what the heck is that? Like, I've never heard of this. I don't use it. It's not like I've used this at every other studio.
Right. So it kind of goes against the idea of widely adopted, right?
Yeah.
Which is what you said, but you said that that's changed.
Yeah, but well, that's for incubation. It's not about widely adopted.
Exactly. Okay.
Incubation is about like, hey, a free and open source render queue. That actually sounds pretty cool. Like we all need a render queue.
Right.
Like let's look to see, and this one's going to be very cloud friendly because
right.
it's sponsored by Google, right?
Right.
So let's look to see how this will grow. And right. so whether it's because they need some level of support, or they need really some validation, is like, oh wait, the Academy thinks that this is good enough to incubate. That's enough for me to investigate it. Versus this is some random sure. thing that I found on the internet, right?
Right.
So there's those aspects. There is an idea of Premier members are contributing actual manpower or FD full time equivalents. Of resource in order to help support and maintain these projects. Currently for this initial phase,
yep.
it was just as long as you're contributing those full-time equivalents to doing open source software contribution.
Right.
That was fine. So for us and Animalogic, we've developed a plugin to Maya called ALUSD Maya.
Okay.
Which is really, so hopefully a lot of your listeners are familiar with USD, the Pixar yep. product, the Universal Scene Description.
Yeah.
They have a plugin that comes with that, a module to import USD into Maya.
Right.
But because Pixar doesn't use Maya for animation, it's really focused on just import, export, and the stuff that Pixar actually needs.
Right.
We use Maya throughout. I mean, we also right. used XSI on all the Lego movies. Like,
Little known fact.
Little known fact. But we use Maya throughout our pipeline.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to use USD as that base scene description within Maya.
Right.
And so that's what ALUSD allows and enables. And it was interesting enough that last year at SIGGRAPH, we got together. We're like, look, like girls, we're all pretty. We don't have to have a separate Pixar USD plugin. We don't have to have the ALUSD Maya plugin. And Autodesk, who really should be developing and supporting a Maya USD thing,
yep.
They're looking at this like, let's all be friends. Let's all get together. And so we announced that we're trying to figure out how to join those and release those under an Autodesk repo. So it's Switzerland.
It's what we need. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Especially if people are going to start using USD or whatever, even Olympic, I don't care. You know what I mean? It's like, we need something that's a standard, right? So,
right.
And that helps, especially when, if you look at the number of names, at the end of, I'm sure I haven't seen it yet, but, Avengers Endgame, I'm sure there's 20 or 30 studios that are listed under there, mm-hmm. right? And there's a lot of shared assets that have to be traveling between those things. So there needs to be something that allows the standard that can maximize your time where you don't have to rebuild everything for every different studio.
Exactly. And so while the Academy Software Foundation is focused on a lot of these software projects, there's a lot of things that the Visual Effects Society is doing in terms of establishing kind of workflow standards.
Okay.
They're still in draft mode, but they'll be coming out soon.
Interesting.
Around different aspects of how do we all do the same thing together.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's really, really cool. I think it's fascinating to do that. And I'm glad that organization is around. And I've been inspecting it for some of my own ideas, which, hopefully maybe someday we'll figure that out. We'll talk about that later. But I do want to, I remember the last time when you were here, and like I said, I think it was about 2.5 years ago, we were heavily talking about the wider adoption of cloud mm-hmm. from the visual effects industry and how that was going to be the future, but we saw it in the future. But now it's here. Now a lot of people are using the cloud.
Yeah.
And even things that are extremely tight are still using the cloud. Big Marvel movies, Game of Thrones was partially rendered on the cloud, all of that stuff. So things that you would not, all those warning signs that it'll never be because it's the biggest secret that we can't let it leak, whatever, still rendered on the cloud. So it did happen we were talking about it 2.5 years ago. What do you think about today? What do you think is the next thing that's going to really change some of the industry?
A lot of it is still cloud. So what we've talked about so far is rendering on the cloud or backing up data on the cloud.
And
those are kind of bog standard right now. But if you look, what I was alluding to, what Adrian said, or working with Nimble Collective or any of these companies that are doing the entire, actually doing everything in the cloud.
You're virtualizing everything.
All your data is stored in the cloud.
You can do it on a Chromebook.
Yeah. And actually this is a little bit about what I, because if I remember back, I was on this rant back then about this idea of a studio in a box, right?
Right.
And the studios themselves could say, hey, yes, you're going to do this work for us. Here, you have access to our cloud or access to these buckets. We've already put all the
assets in there.
All the assets in there.
Yep.
All the DNEG in there. And then so you can pull that up, you can do that work. And we've given you specific permissions, just like Beyond Corp is this idea of giving some level of trust. Mm-hmm. We've given you the trust to work on these assets, but it's still my data and my cloud. I can pull that away from you at any time. So you go bankrupt, great, no problem. I don't have to try and get your data out of bankruptcy. I can just switch it to the other vendor. I can turn it up, turn it down. I'm a studio, so I can have a very large agreement with a cloud provider so that our costs are actually make much more sense than what you could do as an individual.
Right.
Right. So I do think that that's still in the future. Okay. Maybe not on the sure about when the studio side will happen, but thinking about how we then, once we flip our data, all the production content data to be in the cloud, then that changes a lot of different things.
So you really, we're going to go back to dumb terminals at our workstations.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't see a reason to have a workstation at my desk.
No. I don't see it either. And actually, because you move your desk around, we like to we're hyperactive in terms of how we aggregate and assemble, right? You're on this production, yes, we're on animated features for the most part. So you're on this production for a long period of time, but in a commercial, everybody on the commercial gets together, you never worked in facilities or anything, like those poor people have to move workstations around and move people's desks around all the time.
Right.
There's no actual
reason.
You don't have to do that if it's all virtualized.
Yeah.
You have to, I mean, people have to move all their little figurines on their desk from one desk to the other.
It was, okay, so it's interesting because I, so back when I was, before I joined Visual Facts, I was still an architect. There was another friend of mine who was an architect, who is an architect, same company as I, but he used to work for another company and they designed the interior of ImageWorks, right? Mm. And so he was working there and he said, well, what they did then, it was very revolutionary, is they basically had giant KVMs that went to everyone's desk, right? Mm-hmm. So all the workstations were actually in one giant machine room.
Yeah.
And then everyone had a KVM and you basically logged in, which was kind of like a mini version of a cloud, except the cloud is completely on-prem, right? Yeah. And then by the time I got there, that was all abandoned. Hmm. And there was another, there was a computer at my desk.
Well, it wasn't cheap at the time.
Yeah.
It can be a lot cheaper now.
Yeah. Right? So and then now I'm sure it's all gone again. It's now, but it's not even in the machine. It's somewhere in, you know, Utah or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. All the machines in ImageWorks Vancouver are all virtualized.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's very interesting. And that's, I mean, that's yeah, it's a good thing.
I think the other thing that, you know, you'll actually see some of this stuff. I think Blue Sky is there. Hopefully going to be announcing some stuff at SIGGRAPH to follow on to what they announced last year at SIGGRAPH of like, right. None of this stuff is special to us. If we develop something, we want to push it out there so everybody can use it.
Right.
You know, there's been a lot, much like I said, corporate security has been influenced by everything outside.
Right.
Cloud was influenced by everything. Some of the way that we develop software is now heavily influenced by people that are developing software as a service products.
Interesting.
Right. So how do you develop, like developing something that's, will be in the cloud native, a cloud native application,
yep.
So that it scales out. It's accessible from any different region,
right?
You know, content, a CDN to put all the media local to you, so that you can have fast access, right?
Right?
Much like you're using any website. Why would that be different from any other application that you're doing at your desk?
Right.
So if you think about, I'm not going to predict like 5 or 10 years out. Like, why would you not see Maya as a service? Why
right.
would you not see like so? I'm just, you know, I can use this component of mine to do this one thing, and it's all cloud-based rather than just even on a virtual workstation.
Right.
Like, why do I have to run an instance of Maya on a workstation? Why isn't there a Maya farm?
Wasn't Clara or something like supposed to be that? It was kind of like a, it was a browser version of a 3D, of a.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are things like that. Yeah. I mean, even incremental
called.
Images, right? Like,
right.
So mental, like when they had these farms, these.
Right.
Rendering farms in the background. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything can be a service. Everything can be a scalable service out there in the cloud. And again, that helps go back to that beyond Corp Zero Trust
well,
security model
that
where
was
you can
our,
just access it.
Yeah. That was our idea behind our cloud. Like mm-hmm. The Chaos Cloud was basically set up there for specifically, I mean, yes, I don't necessarily see big studios, you know, adapting it because they have a very, a much more complex and proprietary system. But if you're a SketchUp artist, an architect, and you basically are working on an underpowered laptop, and it's like, I need to make an 8K rendering right away for this presentation, you just send it to the cloud and it costs you like $1.
Right.
You get it
or
back.
Like, and I mean, yeah. The rendering is inherently scalable. Like instead right. of having to write it as this rendering service, like you can just say, hey, look, I'm just going to run this on 100 machines
yeah.
all at once together.
Yeah.
You can see other things. Like I think Scanline has written their simulation software to do that internally
yeah.
on their,
yeah.
on their,
they have crazy amount
for
of
a while,
computers.
Right? But it's essentially simulation as a service. Right?
Right.
So you can think about doing all those kind of things as a service.
And so you think that we've only scratched the surface of cloud and now we're going to start to seeing much more interesting things.
Yeah. We've been looking at infrastructure as a service for the cloud right now. Just
right.
like how do I move my box from locally at my desktop or my storage locally on site to pushing it off.
Right.
When you start to think of software as a service and writing your software tools and applications to take advantage of that. Let me say, this is not new. There's people that are already doing
sure.
this within our industry.
Right.
But just, and maybe it's on-prem right now, but when it goes off-prem and now it's not just for you particular studio, but this is a service that's being run for everybody.
Right.
I mean, Shotgun is a great example of that.
Right.
Right. Of what you can do when all of a sudden you don't have your on-prem Shotgun servers anymore, but you can actually have this service that actually scales out and services the industry. It's more effective for them to maintain. It's more effective for them to scale. It's easier to like, hey, we've updated the software.
Right.
I don't have to get my up that as a priority for my system administration's team in order to go through and and test it out and do a downtime and push that out. Yeah. That's part of their business, is that they have continuous integration.
I agree that like the days of box software are gone, you know, like it's, and I forgot what it was. I was buying a laptop for someone. I think it might've been someone from work that needed a laptop. And I went to Best Buy, mm-hmm. and I said, it comes with this, you know, free virus protection software. And they gave me like a DVD case. I'm like, that is the most hilarious thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Well, because the first thing you do is you put it in and it's have to download the latest version anyway.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, you gave you a DVD case. Did your machine even have a DVD?
No, it didn't have one. It didn't have one.
Yeah. What am I supposed to do with this?
What am I supposed to do with this? Yeah. So it's just the idea of box software where you pay for it. I mean, because there is, you know, it is obsolete after a while. So might as well just, you know, make sure you get the latest one all the time. Yeah. So we have two renderers, right? We have mm-hmm. VRAM, we have Corona as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Corona has always been a monthly subscription. And the, you know, I was talking to the owner, it's like, yeah, we're not going to even worry about versioning anymore. You're just going to always have the latest version. And that's kind of a different way of, you know, thinking about it.
Yeah. It's like, it's freeing to the end user. I mean, it can be truly stressful to the software provider,
right.
but also certainly freeing. Here's a fun fact about that stuff. Since I talked about a bunch of boring business stuff before, mm-hmm. Revenue recognition, really sexy subject here.
Yes, let's talk
revenue
about it.
Recognition. When you're doing shrink wrap software, you're saying version release and version release, and people are paying a maintenance contract versus subscription.
Right.
So this is another advantage. Like, so subscription, like, hey, instead of paying 100% the first year and then 20% each additional year, right. like 30% a year. So over time, my profits grow up. That's why Adobe is super huge right now.
Right.
So that's why everybody's come to that subscription model.
Right.
So there's that aspect to it. But the other nice aspect of it is how you recognize the revenue for those sales.
Okay.
If you're if people are purchasing software and they own it, and then as a part of that maintenance agreement, you're promising things in the future. If you've ever seen any of these public companies that, like, when they're making a pitch in the roadmap, there's this thing called the safe harbor agreement, safe harbor statement at the beginning. It says, anything I'm saying here, you can't hold binding to us about, like, us delivering this.
Sure.
But you kind of can, because you can say, hey, look, I bought your software under the explicit understanding that in the next version, you were going to be doing this.
Right.
And so if you don't do that, mm-hmm. they can't recognize the revenue for that you've purchased that software until they do that.
Right.
So it becomes this financial accounting headache for people. Okay. It's why there was all this, oh, I can't promise this, I can't do this.
Right.
When it's a continuous delivery and they're not promising like this feature is going to be in Maya 2018.
Right.
I'm not to pick on Maya, but in this particular shrink wrap version of the software.
Yep.
That frees you up to just do what's right. To like this feature comes out when it's ready.
Okay.
I don't have to wait for a particular version. I don't have to delay a version because it's not in there. I don't have to not talk about it because if I talk about it, then we can't recognize the revenue until I put it out there. That lowers that a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
But let me talk, use the voice of, you know, the naive user whose mm-hmm. frustration with subscription is, right? And I'd love you to be able to explain this to our users, because I think it's important. So a lot of the big complaints that people have, let's say there's a large company that's in our industry that only sells by
subscription. Starts with an A.
Yeah. It starts with an A. And the big complaint about that is that they feel that they're going to get your money either way because you have no choice. So they're not incentivized to actually provide any meaningful updates on their software. Now, the same is true for another big company called Adobe. Mm-hmm. And I was concerned about that when they went to subscription. But honestly speaking, the updates that I've seen from Adobe are spectacular. And I still use it constantly.
Right. I mean, because honestly, the right answer there is not that I must use this thing. The right answer is to make sure that there's competition.
Right.
Right. So like the subscription thing is like, nice thing about this is
there's not much competition for Photoshop.
There's not much competition for Photoshop, although CorelDRAW just came out of the blue and started and released a new version recently. Really?
Okay.
Right? And then you have Krita, right? Like an open source project, sure. right? Trying to do that stuff,
right.
much like you had GIMP and Film GIMP back in the day.
Yeah.
Like, so there's people trying, right?
Sure.
It is, it's hard to compete. And by the way, like Photoshop got a SciTech award this last year because it was actually developed for our industry.
Right.
Right. Maybe it doesn't feel like it right now. Right. But back in the day,
yeah,
you know, those first two names on that boilerplate,
yep,
on that splash screen were the Knoll brothers. Right.
Right.
So how do you
basically convince someone that a subscription is not necessarily, the death of software in some way, because I think some people feel that way. I don't necessarily feel that way, by the way. Yeah. I'm just saying that this is something that I hear constantly from people.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, it is up to, the thing that I like about subscription is that if you don't like the software, you don't have to continue to pay for it. Right.
Whereas if you don't have a choice.
Whereas in the old days, right, you had a big sunk cost up front. Like I paid that $700 upgrade to Photoshop.
Right.
And so now I kind of feel like I have to use it. And, oh, it's only another 20% to keep going for another year. Okay, I'll do that. I'll do that. Right. You don't have the upfront sunk cost, which is actually incredibly powerful for a business owner.
Sure.
With a flexible workforce.
Right.
Right. It's also, right, like we do take great advantage of like, oh, I don't have to buy licenses to peak. Right.
Right.
I have 90 animators for the next 2 months and then I have 10. Like I don't want to buy those 90. I can rent it for a month.
You can rent it.
It's amazing.
Right? Yes.
So that's the boon to a business owner. For a single individual, which is what you're talking about, it becomes a little bit more challenging, right? They do make it so that, you know, I think all of these have like at least like a 20%, 30% discount if you buy for prepay for the year.
Right.
Right. So I don't need that flexibility. I'm a Photoshop user. That's my business. That's my trade. I got my tool. It's costing this much.
Right.
They can't forget that cost for that year is a fraction of the cost of what it used to cost for that initial version.
Right.
Right. And so if they amortize that, yes, if they amortize that over 5 or 10 years, you're paying more money. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done that shift.
Sure.
Right? It wasn't all about revenue recognition.
Right.
And I think the other aspect is because of that, it does incentivize them. It incentivizes them to keep those customers interested in coming back.
Right.
And whenever the yearly or monthly renewal comes up, like actually my funny this morning, my Creative Cloud subscription renewal is like, hey, this is going to bill at the end of March. And I'm like, do I need this?
Right.
Do I need this at home today? No, I mean, there's other things that I definitely need. I use Acrobat every day because I look at a bunch of legal documents. Like,
right.
Yes, done.
Yes.
Yeah, no problem. Photoshop, well, maybe I'll just go and I'll just use it on a monthly basis or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I think it's interesting.
Yeah, like you've said, you've seen a huge bunch of features come out because they're making more money and because they can actually recognize that revenue and say, hey, look, here's the money that we're getting from this. Now we can reinvest in the product so we can continue to grow and continue to expand that market.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, and you're right. Okay, so competition is your friend in those situations,
yeah,
right? Now, like we're in the rendering business. We're an extremely competitive market. There's lot of really good renders out there. So it's very competitive. So subscription in that area, really all it's doing is stabilizing an income process, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't have to worry about stuff, but we need to continue to make our software extremely good or we will lose customers because like they will drop us in a month as opposed to saying not buying us in 2 or 3 years, which they would have done.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So we have to stay on top of it. Let's just pretend we're going to go to a subscription model, mm-hmm, but that's, which we're not right now.
You heard it here first, Chris.
No, I did not say that. I did not say that. I'm just talking about subscription and competition. That's the thing I think that people are frustrated is there are certain areas that are not competitive, right? I still think that I think it's fascinating. I look at what companies like Adobe are doing and I'm looking at all their R&D work, which is fantastic, especially in their mm-hmm, Sensei stuff, right? That's their all their AI weird stuff going on. But I think that stuff like bringing in substance designers, like that's interesting, right? Now, it may be along the lines of what we talked about earlier where they're just, you know, creating more diversity in their portfolios. Or maybe like, hey, you know, they're doing some really amazing stuff in the fractal and world, and we could use some of that interesting code in our what we do.
Yeah, and there are some of those here's a really boring example of what happened with Solid Angle. Like, we changed to use their licensing stuff. We were using RLM before, and we changed to use Autodesk's licensing system.
Right.
We don't have to support and maintain that anymore.
Yeah.
As a company, like our team, like, I mean, person that did all that stuff, he's still employed there. He's still doing plenty of other work.
Right.
Valuable work. But it was like one thing, like we can benefit from this large scale company of doing this. And sometimes that's a great benefit. Like Sometimes it's not.
And you also have the backup in case something legally happens. You have a huge company back there with a much stronger legal team that could probably manage some of that stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, listen, we've gone way over, Darren, but
we did last time too.
Yeah, we did. But we've talked about a lot of real cool stuff. It's always good to catch up on all this interesting information. I think even the fact that it's been 2 years, we still had a lot of interesting things to talk about. So maybe next time we'll make it less, sure, not as long a period of time, so we can talk about, maybe we make it a yearly thing. It's like, all right, Darren, let's talk about what happened in 2019.
Tech or whatever. Future. Yeah. I'm happy to do that.
That'd be great.
And I listen to your podcast all the time. I get a lot out of it.
So thank
hopefully
you.
People get something out of this one.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. I know I have. So it's been great.
Cool.
Well, thanks, Darren.
All right. Thank you.